Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday morning, the 25th of October. The cover story of Foreign Policy magazine this hour. It is titled Old World, The Graying of the Planet and How It Will Change Everything. The author of the piece is Philip Longman. He's a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation and Schwartz senior fellow at the Washington Monthly. He's written for a number of publications. He is author of The Next Progressive Era, A Blueprint for Broad Prosperity. His previous book, Best Care Anywhere, chronicles the quality transformation of the Veterans Health Administration and applies its lessons for reforming the U.S. healthcare system as a whole. His other books include The Empty Cradle, How Falling Birth Rates Threaten World Prosperity and What to Do About It. He's formerly a senior writer and deputy assisting managing editor at the U.S. News and World Report, and has won many business awards for his business and financial writing. And we're going to have an interesting conversation this hour because I think that we're talking about something that we commonly don't believe is happening. We think that the world is just having more people, more people, more people, and his article runs contrary to that. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hi, Philip. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi. Good to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So you start the article, and we remember him, Paul Ehrlich, who predicted that we would have people starving to death and there would be worldwide hunger, millions of people. He predicted that back in 1968 in the book The Population Bomb. Didn't hold true.
No, he was writing at a time when the rate of world population growth just happened to be peaking, and it's been falling ever since. And the reason it's been falling is this rather bizarre trend that started in Scandinavia in the 1970s and spread south throughout all of Europe and then east across all of the former Soviet Union and China and Japan. By now has reached Canada, much of Latin America. And this is the phenomenon of people having fewer children than are needed to sustain the population over time. Essentially, to make it simple, you know, the average woman in society needs to have at least two children, one to replace herself, one to replace her partner. And because some children don't live to be of reproductive age, about an extra tenth of a child on average. So 2.1 is the birth rate you need to maintain the population. Well, now we have seen that fewer and fewer places in the world any longer maintain that rate. This doesn't mean that world population is going to fall immediately, but it does put it on a course to be falling and meanwhile on a course to be rapidly aging.
And why is that? Why are we having fewer babies all over the world?
Well, people used to think that it was a phenomenon of rich countries, that as life got more cosmopolitan, as women gained more opportunities beyond the roles of motherhood, the opportunity cost of having children went up, the things you had to give up for family life. And so we thought that this was something that rich countries experienced. But now we're seeing that this phenomenon is spreading to countries that are by no means rich. We're seeing it happening in countries like Iran and Mexico and places that now, because of their really unprecedented collapse of birth rates in one generation, are growing old before they grow rich, something we've never really seen before in human history. Now, you know, I think there are many competing explanations for this. I don't think any single one of them is true. But in addition to the economic aspects of trying to raise children in an urban environment, which I think are very big. Half the world's population now lives in urban environments. We also have more subjective factors at work. For example, in Brazil, television didn't come in all at once. It was introduced province by province. And today you can go back and see how birth rates collapsed sequentially as television came in.
Yeah, I found that an interesting part of the article. Why? Because people are no longer in the bedroom. They're in the living room watching television.
Well, this is a great subject for cocktail party conversations.
I'm sure.
Yeah. You know, is it just that the television's on or what's on television? What's on television is basically soap operas, mostly depicting the rich people living the high life in the cities. There are very few children around. What few there are whisked away. You know, the women are lissom, the men are dashing. It's just not a world that depicts family life as anything very positive, and mm-hmm. I think builds an association that people of sophistication, people of wealth, are people who have few, if any, children.
Are there other places in the world, and if so, what are they, where we're experiencing an opposite trend? The population is booming.
Well, there's no place in the world where fertility rates are higher today than they were in the past. This trend is affecting every single nation on Earth, and that includes sub-Saharan Africa, that includes Pakistan, that includes Yemen, that includes other places. Now, population in those places is still growing quite a lot. But why is it growing? It's growing because in the 70s, mostly, there were dramatic declines in infant and child mortality. So a lot of babies who would have died didn't. And so we have a population boom going on for that reason. There's also a momentum effect in population. So if you have a population boom, as the United States did in the 1950s or much of the Middle East had in the 1970s, there comes a point where there's a very high percentage of people of childbearing age 20 years later or so. And that means that even if each one of them is having many fewer children than their parents did, you still get population growth for a while. But the population dynamics are such that after you traverse this early stage of fertility decline, you get very rapid population aging, and then eventually the population starts falling as fast as it came up. And so if we can imagine, you know, how fast world population grew in the 20th century, just imagine it falling that fast or even faster and that much in the next 100 years.
And the article has very interesting statistics about how many old people now are living in Japan and in many countries in the world. And we're talking a population that's going to increase significantly, not people who are old.
Right. Well, we have this tremendous growth in centenarians and such. I think a lot of people are somewhat confused and misled when they hear people like me talking about a graying world. They think, oh, that must be because so many people are living to advanced old ages. And that is a part of it, but a small part. Mm-hmm. Actual life expectancy at age 65 has hardly budged in the last 10 years or so. We see many more people living to be 100, but that's because there's many more people in the pipeline to start with. What's really changed is a dramatic decline in mortality among children and infants. That's largely finished. And meanwhile, even as we spend more and more for healthcare, we're not seeing great improvements in longevity, let alone productive aging. So that's the context in which this is occurring. And really, the aging that we're talking about has more to do with birth rates than it does with people living longer.
Mm-hmm. 65, when you said 65, is that a worldwide average? Because it's closer to 80, isn't it, for some populations in this country?
I'm not sure what you mean.
The lifespan, the average lifespan.
Well, we all have different lifespans at different ages, right? So by the time you're 65, how much longer can you expect to live? That's obviously a much shorter number than when you're zero.
Right.
Right? So when I say life expectancy at 65 is such, I mean that having reached age 65, how much longer can you expect to live?
Oh, I see.
Right? And that's not dramatically different than it was even in 200 years ago.
Hmm.
Right? There were always people who lived into their hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people in the past, when you hear statistics like life expectancy was 40 at the beginning of the 20th century. Well, that's because so many people never lived beyond 6 months,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is not really – we've got a lot more, many more aging people coming. That's a reflection of the baby boom generation aging. It's not a reflection of each baby boomer living that much longer.
Mm-hmm. Here's a statistic that's really a knockout one. By 2150, according to one UN projection, the global population could be half what it is today. I think some people will hear that and say, hooray, that's a great thing. We're using up all our resources. We're too greedy. The planets may not survive because there are too many of us. We mm-hmm. need half the population.
Right. Well, I think, first of all, you know, we should always emphasize the positive. I personally am happy that we didn't face the future that Paul Ehrlich and the population bomb predicted.
Right.
Right. So, you know, but this is kind of a case of, you know, be careful what you wish for. The future we're looking at is not just rolling the reel back, right? It's not. A lot of people would think on first hearing, oh, this is great. That means it'll just be that much easier to get that lakefront property, to get my kids into college. There'll be less traffic. Everything will be better because it's just my day-to-day life is completely compromised by crowding and there'll just be less of that. And, you know, I would suggest that this is not the world that we're looking at. We're looking at a world in which the key fact is that there are fewer workers, productive aged people to support each elderly person. And although there are environmental consequences to these fertility rates, those aren't straightforward either. For example, a society that is spending tremendous amounts of money on health care is a society that has less resources to put into environmental remediation or to breakthrough green technologies and such. And we can talk a lot about what all the environmental ramifications of this are. But it's not so simple as there's fewer people, so everybody remaining gets more.
You mentioned, and I hadn't heard this phrase this way before, China is rapidly evolving into what demographers call a 4-2-1 society, one child becoming responsible for supporting two parents and four grandparents. I never thought of that.
Yeah, and China illustrates a lot of different trends. First, the one trend it illustrates is when in the first phases of this population transition, it's generally associated with prosperity, right? Birth rates go down. There's fewer children. That frees up more women to work in the formal economy. There's less money that has to be spent on raising the next generation. More is available to put into each remaining child. And so around the world, when we've seen this pattern, it's generally been associated with good times for a while. And China's right in that sweet spot right now, demographically. But because of its one child, one family policy, because of the just dramatic fertility decline that happened without the policy, China is aging at this pace that people have never seen before in recorded history. You know, you're going from a society where the average woman had five children a generation ago and now has less than one. And when that change happens that abruptly, the age structure of the population becomes like an inverted pyramid where you have just a few young people at the bottom and a gigantic number of elderly at the top. And that is the thought behind the 4-2-1 society
mm-hmm.
Formulation, which, believe me, is a big preoccupation of Chinese leaders these
yeah,
days.
Yeah, I would imagine. And then you go on to talk about a chronic shortage of women in the coming decades, leaving the most populous region on Earth with the same skewed sex ratios as the early American West.
Yes, well, this is another thing that's been going on. I guess... mostly because the combination of societies that are still traditional enough to very much favor sons over daughters, but modern enough to have access to sonograms and abortion on demand. The net effect in China is that we now have about 116 boys for every 100 girls in that society due to selective abortion. There's no nice way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
This pattern is found in many other places in the world, notably India, too. So what does that mean for society? Well, again, we've not really been here before, right? There's places like the American Wild West where we had that many more men than women. Some historians say late Roman Empire was in that demographic profile. But we don't know what it means. But it would look at first blush to mean that there's going to be about 46 million unmarriageable men wandering around China in the next generation who will not be able to find wives. We're already seeing examples of bride capture and other behavior that's, you know, hasn't been seen in generations elsewhere emerging in China. And, of course, it also depresses the fertility rate if there's not enough women.
Yeah, right. And what's the story in India? Is it due to selective abortion as well, or is there some other reason for more boys than girls?
I think that's it.
It's the same
basically.
Thing.
Huh. Yeah.
We are going to welcome phone calls. Our guest is the author of the cover story on the current foreign policy, One World, the Graying of the Planet and How It Will Change Everything. Philip Longman, Senior Research Fellow, Economic Growth Program and Research Director, Next Social Contract Initiative, Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation, and Schwartz Senior Fellow at the Washington Monthly is our guest. He's the author of the article. Here's the number again, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, should you care to use that, is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This coming Friday, October 29th, the Ideas Network will be carrying the final gubernatorial debate between Republican Scott Walker and Democrat Tom Barrett. This We the People begins at 7 o'clock, and you can hear the debate live here on the Ideas Network, or you can also listen online at WPR.org. The final gubernatorial debate, October 29, here at 7 o'clock on the Ideas Network. Let's start phone calls. Grant in Appleton, our first caller. Hi, Grant.
Hi. I found it very interesting what the guest was saying about world population. And I guess about 10 years ago, I was caught up in the, you know, everyone was thinking that the population was going to explode. And I was really thinking about the health of the planet. And what it needed was less people. And I heard what he said about the benefits or the harm it might do to the human population. But if we really think about the health of the planet, it's overall going to be a positive thing. You know, the Earth would do just fine without any humans. So I guess that's my perspective.
Okay.
Well, I always say if your answer to the question, what is zero, what is ideal human population? If your answer to that question is zero, then I can't really talk to you.
Right? Nobody would be able to talk to anybody. Right.
Right. But I'm wholly sympathetic and myself preoccupied with the problems of the planet. I ask you to think, though, about some of these ramifications that might be involved. They're not straightforward. They're not simple because, as I said, we've never been here before. But in a world in which there are many more elders and fewer children, right, there are all kinds of ways in which this is not necessarily good for the planet. I already mentioned one, right, which is the money that you have to spend to support an elderly population is money you can't spend on environmental remediation, on the emergence of truly green technology. And, you know, I believe we see that in the United States right today, that instead of talking about implementing gigantic moonshot-type programs to get us to sustainable energy consumption, you know, we're talking about the future of Medicare and the future of Social Security. Another thing to realize is that, at least so far, decline in birth rates has been associated with more pollution. And that, why do I say that? It's because as countries like first Japan and then China have gone through this demographic transition, it's not as if they have lowered their carbon emissions. What the pattern so far has been that as there are fewer people, in a society, each one consumes more. And so today in China, for example, per capita and total CO2 emissions are much higher than they were a generation ago, even though the average family has gone from five to one, right? But that one remaining little emperor is living a life that puts a much bigger footprint on the planet than his five peasant forebears did in the previous generation.
That one little emperor.
Oh, my.
Right. Yeah. So this is all about how we live, right? Not so much about how many of us there are. And in fact, as there are more of us, there are more brains to put to problems like how to solve global warming, right? But so far, the dynamic has been that population aging has led to more per person, or at least it's been coincidental with more per person pollution and energy consumption.
And then those older people, too. This sort of knocks you in the head when you read this part of your article. You cite this recent Rand Corporation study in health affairs. More than 40% of Americans ages 50 to 64 already have difficulties performing ordinary activities of daily life, such as walking a quarter mile or climbing 10 steps without resting. We're not in very good shape, so we can't contribute very much, huh?
Yeah, this is one of the things that bothers me so much about the state of the conversation in the United States and around the world on this aging front. Is the first thing many people say when they are confronted with the sort of fiscal challenges of an aging society, well, everybody's going to live longer, so we'll let everybody work longer too, right? It's just kind of the facile, easy solution to the problems in Medicare and Social Security, or so folks think. But the problem is that both physically and mentally, we're going backwards. I mean, there's just no nice way to say it, and I'm old enough now that I can say this without being accused of ageism, right? Right? That the physical fitness of people in late middle age in the United States is not what it was 30 years ago. It's going backwards. Rates of disability among people in their 50s is going up. It's skyrocketing.
Goodness.
It's even going up among children, right? And this is mostly about obesity. And it makes total common sense if you just walk around the world and look for it, right? The moment it came to me is one day when I went into Walmart and turned to my right and saw 25 scooters lined up against the wall for all those people who were not fit enough to shop in Walmart without being in an electric cart. And I realized then, well, you know, people always said that the elderly, you know, in the future can always work as greeters at Walmart. And now we're looking at a population where already we have so many people suffering with obesity, diabetes, associated chronic illness, that, you know, Walmart feels it has to have these fleets now of golf carts, right?
Right.
So, you know, let's stop all the happy talk about productive aging. There's much more we can be doing as individuals, we should be doing. There's much more society we can do to make greater use of our elderly. But, you know, let's just not kid ourselves that on current course, we're not headed for a gigantic health problem and poverty problem among the elderly.
Mm-hmm. Karen in Hillsborough is next. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I had heard of a recent Russian study involving hamsters and GMO foods and how hamsters were fed only GMO foods. And for the first two generations, there was no impact. But the third generation was 100% sterile. And I wanted to find out, my question is, have you heard of this? And what impact would that have on this topic? And I can take my answers up.
Okay, thanks, Karen.
Sure. So I think she was saying GMO is in genetically modified organization.
Right.
Right? Organism. It's an obvious question to ask. Is there something in the environment that is changing the biological fertility of people, right? And could that be genetically modified organisms? Could that be chemicals in the food supply? Could that be some other environmental aspect? And the answer to that, and I have looked for it hard, is there's nothing definitive that we could point to say, oh, that's it. right? This decline in fertility is much more about people making life choices that don't result in children, right? Either because they wait too long to try to have children, which explains a huge number of fertility clinics out there in the world today, or because they use family planning. And so these trends that I'm talking about appear to be mostly the result of decisions people have made as individuals, not of some environmental factor that is preventing them from having children.
Thanks for the call. This is interesting, and I wanted my mind to go this direction, and then you kind of knocked this down too. This idea that, and I guess it came from scholar Mark Haas, who talk about, speak of this geriatric piece, that if you've got single-child families, you wouldn't want to have military conscription because you'd lose your child. The rising cost of pensions and health care should also make sustaining military buildups increasingly difficult. So, a more peaceful world as a result of all of this, no?
Well, could be. you know, I think we have seen something like that dynamic in places in the world. I think one way to look at the course that Northern Ireland has been on from the 60s till now is one that's largely explained by aging. People eventually, the society was no longer dominated by young men in their 20s. It was dominated by old men in their 60s, and they became to have a different outlook.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, you know, we can kind of see this anecdotally in Europe, where when European baby boom was still young in the 70s and 80s. We had groups like Bader Meinhof and the Brigati Rossi and other domestic terrorism groups who were wrecking havoc in Europe in mid-1980s, and they kind of aged out of it. So that's the thought, that there might be something kind of like a geriatric piece, that as the demographic center of gravity is no longer among young adults, but rather dominated by middle-aged and older people and their sensibilities and their life concerns, that we'll have less attraction to extremism and more reluctance to give up what few children we have to put it into military endeavors and like that. But against this, we can see again and again in history too, that as various ethnic groups come to feel that they are on demographic decline or demographically threatened, they often respond quite violently.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's not well remembered today, but in 100 years ago in the Western world, we had this gigantic movement called the eugenics movement,
right,
which was all about basically white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in the United States feeling like they were being outbred. And in places like Germany, folks there feeling that they were being outbred by, you know, sometimes called the dusky races. And this was part of the whole precondition for fascism, mm-hmm. frankly, you mm-hmm. know, and the rhetoric of fascism often focused on fertility and breeding and master races and all this kind of stuff. It can be quite dangerous when a people begin to feel like they're being outbred.
Let's go to Craig from Onalaska. Hi, Craig.
Good morning. I have basically two comments. One, I lived in the Philippines, and I saw firsthand the problems of overpopulation. Many Filipinos that I knew, you know, they would admit that their country would have been much better off with a smaller population. Second comment that I would like to make is I think that the guest speaker is overlooking one fact. When you have a population that only allows one child, and you're saying, well, that one child can't take care of the elderly as they grow older and older, nature takes care of that very easily by having that elderly generation pass away. So I think that, yeah, there is a period of time where things may be a little rough and a little harder. But then I think after that big bump in population dies off and you get back to a smaller population, the country and the world would be much better off.
Well, if the average woman in a society only has one child, it never comes to a steady state. Every generation is producing half as many children as is needed to sustain the current population. So you're getting smaller and smaller and smaller, but also aging and aging on your road to extinction. So I take your point that, you know, we can evolve through this gigantic mega trend in ways that aren't horrible. And I hope I'm not giving the impression that I think the world's just going to end for all this. But unless we find some way for people to have at least two children over time, the road is extinction. I mean, there's no other way to say it.
Craig?
I don't want to give the impression that I think that, you know, one child is going to be the rule for everything. I think, you know, nations will, if they get over that big bump in population, they can then set a goal of having 1.5 children per, you know, mother. So there's ways of doing it. It's just that when you have, like I say, when I was in the Philippines, you'd see, you know, these young families that had 6, 8, 10 kids, and those kids were doomed to having, you know, poverty problems for the most part. So I think that, you know, governments will do what they need to do. If they can get their population down to a level that works for their country, they can then, you know, suggest and make, you know, programs to encourage women to have more children if they need to. But once you have huge population, it's like a farm. You can only put so many animals on a farm before that farm begins to have a lot of difficulty. And you have to be able to say, okay, this farm can only carry 30 cattle. And if you try to carry 60, you're going to have major problems. There isn't one animal on that farm that does well. And same in these poor countries, when they have, you know, 8, 10, 12, 15 kids, it just creates problems for everybody. And, you know, I'm sorry, but I think the world needs fewer people. I'm 61. And I can, you know, remember in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, you could go do things in, we'll say, national parks, to use an example. Nowadays, you can't even get into those national parks. They're so crowded because there's such a huge increase. You know, I think our population since World War II has more than doubled. And I can't see that that's, you know, always an advantage.
Well, a couple of points. I mean, it might surprise you to know that the population density of the Philippines is but a fraction of what it is in the Netherlands. So it might strike you, and it struck me in travels to the third world, that, oh my goodness, if there just were so fewer people here, they'd be richer. But we have to think carefully about what actually is the relationship between population and economic development now. Because when we look around the world, we see that the richest countries, by and large, are also the ones that had the most gigantic population explosions in the 18th and 19th century, and that even today are still the most densely populated. So after the Netherlands, you know, we have Japan. And Europe in general, you know, has a very much higher population density than Africa does. So, you know, if we... If we take the world as we find it, we would say, well, maybe the actual association between economic development and population growth is the opposite of what it might at first seem. You know, the other thing is, you know, be careful what you wish for. Nobody is more irritated than I not to be able to get into my favorite fishing hole, in my favorite campsite and all of that. All of us walk around all the time with this sensation of crowding, and it's a source of irritation. And it stands to reason that that people would instantly think from that, well, gee, it would just be so much better if there were that many fewer people, right? But again, these relationships are not as straightforward as you might seem. For example, the population of Germany is declining. The population of German cars is exploding, right? Right. So in Rome, right, where for a generation now, the average family size has been one child, right, where the number of women of reproductive age is now so small that if each one of them went out and had three children, Italy's population would still shrink.
Goodness.
The traffic, right? The traffic the traffic is worse in Rome than it ever was, right? And that's, again, because of what these remaining people do with themselves, right? So I would say, you know, the problem that's irritating you at Yellowstone might have more to do with the Winnebagos and RVs on the road than mm-hmm. with the people.
Right. Now, oh, that's very interesting. Can we spend just a few more moments before we go back to phone calls? Because you make mention of the fact that the rise in certain groups, perhaps Muslim immigrants here in the United States, immigrants from Mexico who tend to have higher birth rates. You also talk about fear of demographic decline fueling the resurgence of Hindu nationalism in India. Can you talk about that and how it's playing out in various places in the world?
Well, you know, I think we touched on that a little bit. You know, some other examples would be all the troubles in the Balkans in the 90s,
right.
Largely reflecting the decline in Serbian fertility there, which led to a Serbian nationalism that led to, well, we know what. Right.
Right.
Lebanon's civil war, you know, part of the whole context of that is the decline in Christian fertility in Lebanon and the social turmoil that grew when the relative size of these different populations changed. You know, we talked about we already talked about the fascist era. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But, you know, I'll be a little provocative here and say I hear in town hall meetings around the country, many people standing up and saying, I want my country back. What does that mean? What are you saying? Right. I think a large part of what people are saying when they express that thought is there's some sense in which my people are being outbred. We're no longer in the demographic majority, and that upsets me, and it makes me want to have this particular politics. And so there's nothing necessarily progressive or liberal about this kind of population decline. It can lead to exactly the opposite world that you want.
Right. Stephen in Fish Creek, hi.
Hi. I'm going to pull over right now. And
thank
talk.
You. Okay.
I lived in China for about 6 months, and the first shock that I had was that everybody I met had brothers and sisters, and I thought, what's that all about? How does that work? And they were all mostly farmer kids who came into the city to work, and they all had brothers and sisters, and all the farm families in China don't have the one-child policy. And then all the ethnic minority groups in China, there's 52, which would be the equivalent of our Native American tribes, 52 recognized tribal groups in China that don't have the one-child policy. So I found that one child was mostly rich people who lived in the big cities like Shanghai and Beijing. They had mm-hmm. the one-child policy, and if they wanted to break it, they could pay a fee and have more kids. So I don't believe what you're saying is actually true. Secondly, every day when I went to the parks that are all over China, they were filled with old people out exercising and playing cards in the snow, having fun, dancing. You know, our culture is the one that has the problem. America, yeah, we have a real problem here. Secondly, I also really liked the crowds. I felt good in crowds of people in China. I felt like I was in like a hive, like it was wonderful to have lots of people. So I think we're spoiled, fat, and rich. And I think if we can end war, we're going to be in great shape in this country because we'll have the money to support older people. And I don't like the whole dark cloud mentality that I feel that your guest is projecting. I don't believe it.
All right. Thanks.
I'll just listen to your reaction to that.
All right. Thanks, Stephen.
Well, many things to say. But I think he's absolutely right about the higher fertility in China in the countryside. This is a pattern we see around the world. A key thing to remember about China, and I said this before, is the policy itself is only weakly related to its fertility decline. And why do I say that? Because we've seen even faster fertility declines in every nation that borders China without the policy, right? So Korea didn't need a policy to get to where the average woman now has 1.3 children, right? And neither did Japan, and neither does Vietnam, which is following the same course very quickly. And by the way, the Philippines are now on this course too, although they're late in coming to it. So what's really going on, and he's got his finger on something here, is that when people move from the countryside to the cities, which has been going on a gigantic scale in China, the economics of child rearing completely changed. Children go from being an economic asset to being an avoidable liability. You know, in the countryside, they can be useful in farm activities. In the city, it's just more rent and more expense. And so people respond to that change in their environment by having many fewer children. So the lowest of the low fertility on the planet right now is Hong Kong, where there is no countryside, right? It's just one gigantic, very dense city. And there, the birth rate is way below one, right? Right? Even though most of those people who are having no children or only one are by all standard economic measures among the most affluent people on the planet, right? So it really is about, I think, in the end, restoring the economic basis of the family that once we have created in our modern societies worlds in which it really doesn't make economic sense to have children. And so the only folks who go on to have children nonetheless are people who are either incredibly improvident or who are motivated by higher or different callings. And that's why we see in the world this other gigantic pattern that we haven't seen thus talked about thus far, which is that people of religious faith, and particularly those who have a literal belief in any of the three major Abrahamic traditions, you know, Islam, Judaism, or Christianity, that's where you find the exception to this rule. That's where you find the high fertility now among the ultra-Orthodox in Israel, among the Islamic fundamentalists elsewhere, and among Christian fundamentalists in the United States and elsewhere. And that's because those are people who are responding to different signals.
So what will that mean? What does that mean for the composition of nations and for that also has created problems in the past?
Well, to put it bluntly, as you know, one recent book on this subject is titled, The Religious Shall Inherit the Earth. There are concurrent trends, and if only by default, right? Because even among the devout, or however we want to describe such folks, their fertility is falling too. It's just not falling anywhere near as fast as it is everywhere else. So the difference is still big. And this, again, is something that's never happened before, at least in recorded history, right? In the big years of the American baby boom, pretty much everybody was exhibiting the same reproductive behavior, right? Catholics had slightly more children than Protestants, but there wasn't a big difference. Now there's gigantic differences to the point that if you do something like just take the birth rates of all the countries that are all the states in the United States that voted for George Bush in 2004 and all those that voted for John Kerry in 2004, well, the Kerry nation, the blue America, if you will, has, you know, a birth rate that is as low as anything you'd find in Europe, whereas red America has this much higher one. So it's not just the religious nexus, but also a political orientation, too, that is now associated with this reproductive behavior. And again, you know, I say to my progressive friends, be careful what you wish for, you know, if you were going to just take the position that society should send no signals to anybody except don't have children.
More phone calls in a moment. Philip Longman is our guest. He is the author of the cover story piece in Foreign Policy magazine, the current issue, Old World, the Graying of the Planet and How It Will Change Everything. He's a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation, and he is Schwartz Senior Fellow at Washington Monthly. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We've been so busy that I haven't had a chance to tell you much about this, but we are going to Washington, D.C. And Gettysburg, March 30th through April 5. We're inviting our wonderful listeners to join us. We'll be taking a bus, and we will go to Gettysburg. We'll be doing a lot of things in Washington. We'll also go to Mount Vernon, the home of George and Martha Washington. We will do a live broadcast from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. We'll be there during, we hope, cherry blossom time. We've timed it so that the blossoms should be in full bloom. And we'll have a chance to really get to talk to each other. It's going to be quite a trip. When we went to Springfield a year ago this time, we pulled people on the bus and said, where would you like to go next? Because everybody wanted to take another trip, and the vast majority wanted to go to Washington. So we're going to Washington. Please call Progressive Travel for more information about this trip. And that number is 800-231-4391. 800-231-4391. Let's go back to phone calls now for Philip, and we go to Bob from Amherst. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to understand a little bit more the correlation between the demographics and the fecundity rates of the population to these other peripherally related issues like per capita resource utilization and environmental degradation. These other types of topics have all kinds of connections and relationships and correlations to other things, resource utilization being correlated very closely with pollution, for example, and environmental destruction, like global weirding. They don't necessarily, in my mind, correlate directly to the demographics of the human population. It seems like there could be just as strong an argument made that regardless of what the impact might be on these other topics, we're better off with a lower population in any case.
Okay, Philip.
Well, I thought I was agreeing with him until that last sentence. If the correlations aren't there, and that's part of what I'm trying to get across, is that the amount of CO2 we put into the air has much more to do with how each person lives than in how many people there are, right? To that extent, I totally agree. And I also can agree that we could have fewer people on this planet and it would not be the end of the world. It won't be the end of the world. We will have fewer people on this planet in our children's lifetime. And it won't be the end of the world, and there'll be good things that come of it. But let's not, my message is that let us not just sit back and be sanguine about all that's involved in this transition, because there are many things that will be painful and need to be prepared for, right? We are like fish who don't know they're in water. We are in a society that has always taken robust population growth for granted. And so we don't know what it's like really when it's gone, right? Population growth has been good to capitalism. Population growth creates more of the consumers that capitalists sell to, and it creates more of the workers that whose labor capitalists buy. Population growth has been very good to socialism. You know, a growing country can have a social security system that pays more out to each person who goes through the system than they paid in, because there's just a growing population. The tax base is always increasing for that reason. These things that we take for granted now, we can't take for granted in this new world that's coming, and we just have to prepare for them.
We have about 30 seconds left. If we can accomplish a short answer in question. Audrey, hi.
Oh, I'll try to do this quickly.
Okay.
I'm 80 years old. I've had two knees replaced. I've had gut surgery because of a ruptured appendix. Now, hasn't society spent enough money on me?
Oh, Audrey.
Now, wait a minute. Now, wait. Let's look at the back side of this. Why not take care to see that the older people end their life at a certain time? It's not bad, you know, to go under and have a surgery. You don't feel anything. And I see too many people, 95 years old, sitting around in a chair because somebody says, oh, it's so good. That
okay, we have about 20 seconds. Philip? What do you say, Philip?
The good news is we do not need death panels or euthanasia to get through this.
Okay. Thank you so much for being with us. And I like the way you sounded, Audrey. Stay with us a while longer. Philip Longman, Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation. His piece is in the current issue of Foreign Policy magazine, Old World, the Graying of the Planet and How It Will Change Everything. It will provoke a lot more thought and conversation once you read it. We thank him for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour and for doing on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Be with you again tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.